Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is lecture 11, Color. So I know that you may wonder what on earth we could talk about with color, just like you may have wondered the same thing with the histogram, but rest assured that this is a particularly heinous topic, especially if you have looked at some of the color management settings in, say, Photoshop and been lost in these words that you know individually what they might mean, but put together, they just become meaningless. And so that is part of what we are going to try to talk about today. So first of all, I did just want to mention a couple of things. So don't forget that the final project proposals were due today, but also we published the instructions for sending us your final projects. Realize that these are modified instructions for submitting files to us, because now we are allowing more than just images. So, for example, if you were to create a book, for example, out of your images that you make for your final project, or a website, or something like that, any type of file that is not a JPEG will be difficult or practically impossible to upload to Flickr. So we had to supplement that by rolling our own sort of submission code. So just to give you a very general overview, any images that you create for the final project and that are final images. So for example, if you make a book and you have, I don't know, a dozen or so images in that book or more, for example, then you will submit those JPEG files to us separately into Flickr, just as you always have with these assignments up until now. And so you'll give it a specific tag when you upload it to the Flickr group. I added it here, E7 final project, no spaces, you can take a look at this page. So this URL is actually provided in the final project specification, but if you're curious, just offhand, it's cse7.org/final project. You'll be able to get all of these same instructions that I'm telling you now in print form so that you can read it and go through it. So you will submit all of your images in JPEG form to Flickr, as you always have. Then if you have any supplemental files, so let's say you have a PDF of a book, or maybe you have a PowerPoint presentation, or a movie, or a collection of files that put together represent a web page, what you will do is send us those files via this upload form. And this form, you will basically log in, you'll authenticate with Flickr, that tells us who you are, and then you'll be able to upload all of those files to our server here, and then we'll be able to get the entirety of your final project and be able to get around Flickr's limitations at the same time. Keep in mind that there is also just a very short basically how-to paper that we're hoping you'll write for the final project, or expecting you to write, rather, for the final project. And that file, as it is also a supplemental file, should be uploaded here as well. So unlike previous assignments where we've had you email that to us, please don't email that to us. Just upload all of your stuff to the internet. The JPEG files to Flickr, and the paper and everything else to the website. And if you have any questions about that, we'll be able to clarify, certainly. And of course, I do want to mention that our first ever E7 field trip, I think, went over pretty well. So thank you very much, John, for organizing, and for all of you that came. It was a lot of fun, and the weather cooperated very well, I think, for the entirety of the day. Okay, so just as a quick reminder, as a quick review of some of the topics that we went over last week when we were talking about digital cameras specifically and the sensors within them, we broke down actually the components of the sensor, and we showed this particular diagram, which represents, or which shows you, some of the various items that can be found within a digital camera sensor. So the very top layer is a micro lens that focuses light that comes into the mirror box and focuses it down into the sensor well, because as you remember, there's a lot of electronics surrounding the very small portion that actually can detect the light. We want to be able to make sure that we can focus as much of that light as possible into that photodiode. Underneath the micro lens, we have a color filter array. This applies for most of the cameras, the digital cameras that are out there today, except for the ones that are of that Bayer type, if you remember, because that was a different type of sensor that removes the need for this color filter array. The point of this is that we can then recombine, using demosaicing, the colors that made up the particular scene at a later point in time. There is a missing layer from this excuse me, from this particular diagram, and that is the anti-alias filter that's usually found even on, it's on the very top, so even above the micro lenses. And the point of that is to get over these problems that we have with demosaicing, where because we have now a couple of pixels that have to be combined later on to represent one color, we can get these weird patterns that can emerge after we recombine this data, especially if the patterns are very, very fine on the sensor itself. And so the point of the anti-alias filter is to soften it a little bit, soften the frequencies or the high frequency patterns that are coming into the sensor, and soften it and be able to eliminate a lot of those problems. And so if we take a look then at the color filter array, we notice that most of them come in this particular pattern, what's called the Bayer color filter array, and there's a predominance of the green filters in this, and that is because, as we discussed, the green is the most important color for us to detect luminance, and the camera is able to use this to its advantage when it is recombining all of the data and creating not only the colors themselves in the final photograph, but also the luminance or the brightness of a particular pixel. And so as a result of this, because every pixel on this sensor can't detect all of the colors, we have, of course, that problem of needing to demosaic all of this information. So we have to later on recombine this data. So we take data from four neighboring pixels, recombine it, and then try to figure out what the original color was, what the original color might have been, and also what the original brightness might have been for that particular pixel. Now, also because of this problem, we also have fewer effective pixels. So the end result of the image, it has fewer pixels than the actual sensor has as well. And that is because these very edge-most pixels don't have neighboring pixels on this side to be able to compute any additional data for. And so it just becomes this problem. Well, you have to end it somewhere. You have to be able to end this demosaicing algorithm at some point, and that is why we have fewer effective megapixels. Now, one of the few types of sensors that don't actually require a color filter array, and remember there are different types of color filter arrays where they're in different arrangements, is this Fovian X3 type sensor. And we don't see very much of these, but they do exist. And the whole point of these is that we have at one pixel three different sensors that can detect each of the three major colors within one pixel. And so we can recombine this data later, but it's sharper, it's more accurate in terms of the detail, not necessarily the color itself, but in terms of the detail, because we don't have to worry about recombining this data with pixels that are neighboring of each other, that are neighbors to each other. And so we will be able to get much, much better defined details out of it. And so we typically find that the Fovian sensors have smaller, or rather fewer amounts of megapixels than a typical Bayer sensor. And that's from not only this reason that we have that much data to begin with, but also that the research just isn't there for these types of sensors. So these are, it's an interesting sensor, but it also has its downfalls as well. Like there's going to be more noise in the color regions because we have to recombine the data from these three sensors for that one pixel, try to figure out what the colors were originally for that. Keep in mind that all of the, so you'll notice that through this amount of silicon, the red light, for example, travels the farthest. And so if we have a photodiode at the very top layer trying to detect the blue wavelengths, we will get not only the blue, but also the greens and also the reds. So we get everything. We have to do something to try to figure that out. And try to figure out what the blue component was later on. So we get this, we see this predominance in blue noise in these particular sensors because it is not very accurate. Then we talked about dynamic range and how, of course, if we have, if we're capturing an amount of light within a scene, we have this range from dark to bright that we can capture within the camera. And the sensor is responsible for the dynamic range that it can capture. So it has to do not only with the size of the pixels, but Also, you know, how new the technology is and how little noise it has when reading these pixels. And when we, after we capture this information, we have this problem of the sensor being this analog device. So it's not digital immediately. We have to convert it into a digital signal. And that is the job of this ADC, or this analog to digital converter. And what all that does is it just reads how full essentially that pixel is, and then it converts it to a binary number, and then it will be able to provide that binary number to the camera CPU to be able to process or to do something with. And we talked about how we can have a sensor that has very high dynamic range, but if we have an ADC that has a low sampling, then that is that could be bad for us, because we may not have then the tonal range within that within the possible dynamic range of the sensor, because we don't have enough values in the ADC to represent all of the values that the sensor can represent. So we typically see very high sampling bits from an analog to digital converter. Now, when we are capturing an image, so unlike our eyes, which play tricks on us when we're looking at objects that are reflecting or emitting light, these sensors, they are purely linear devices. So however much light they capture, that's how much light they will report. And so the results of this is, if you were to look at just the image as if it were linear and just completely off the sensor, so it would look very, very dark, because it's not how we view the world. And so we have to apply what's called a tone curve to be able to map what the sensor actually reads to how we would actually view that particular scene. Somebody's very anxious out there to get their horn heard. Okay, anyway, this is a general type of tone curve that we see, and we even talked about a tone curve analog very early on when we did one of the software lectures, how we, if you remember that, that curves tool in Photoshop, what we were able to do was apply a tone curve of sorts to a file and make it a little bit contrastier, or make it a little bit less contrasty. Realize that that's not the same thing, because normally you're already working on an image who has had a tone curve applied to it already, so you're not actually modifying the tone curve that made that image, you're just applying an extra one there. So in the camera or on your computer, when you're processing a raw file, you are applying a raw curve like this, or rather a tone curve, that overrepresents the middle few stops of the sensor. So basically it's placing the most importance on these middle few stops of the sensor, and less importance on not only the dark regions, the shadows regions, but also the highlights of that particular image as well. And so after this tone curve is applied, it essentially compresses the highlights and the shadows. And because in a JPEG, after it's been converted to a JPEG file or saved as a JPEG file, we have so few bits of data to work with, we are throwing away a lot of information at both ends of the spectrum. And so we use this as a reason, among many others, to use RAW over JPEG if you want the most quality out of your images. You will have the best ability to be able to modify them with the least impact on, or the least negative impact on quality. And as you'll see today, when we start talking about color, that same sort of thing applies even to a lot of these details that we'll be talking about today. So in order for us to really talk about color and how it works in the digital realm, we have to take another step back and talk about the eye again. So just as a quick review from many, many lectures ago, we talked about the eye and what the differences are between some of the cells that exist within the eye. So if you remember, we have, this is obviously an eye, and then we have the light that comes in. It's focused by the lens, comes in through the iris, and it's focused basically everywhere on the back of the retina. But we have this portion of the eye called the macula, where we have the highest concentration of a particular type of cell. And this cell provides us with this detailed vision that we are very accustomed to having. And in fact, we have these two different types of cells within our retinas, the rod cells and the cone cells, and they do very, very different things. The rods, for example, they're responsible for night vision, and they detect motion very well. They're not really in the fovea, but they are scattered through, you know, around it. So they are what predominates in your peripheral vision. And they're stimulated by monochromatic light, so they cannot view color, for example. This is opposed to the cones, which provides us our detailed viewing in the smallest 2% of our vision. So right in the center of our vision, we have a predominance of cones. It's less sensitive to light, which means that it's very good for day vision. It's concentrated in the fovea, as I said, right in the center of our vision. They're stimulated by color light, and this is what gives us our color vision. And they have a preference to detect detail. And so we showed this graph here, which, as you will remember, represents not only the rods and the cones, but we can further break down the cone cells into three different types of cells. So we have an S type, an M type, and an L type, which basically signify what wavelengths of light we are able to detect with those particular types of cones. And as you might remember, we have, of these three types, the M and the L type are the most present in our fovea. So in the average person, it's about 98% of these two types of cells versus the poor little S type only gets about 2%. And the dotted line here represents the response from our rod cones, or rather our rod cells. And as you can see, it drops off significantly right before the red. So because the rod cells don't actually get stimulated by red light, when you're, you know, just as a quick reminder, when it's dark outside and you need some little bit of night vision, it's good to use very, very red light. So nothing that has a mix of light, but pure red light will not destroy your night vision, because it's not going to stimulate your rod cells into readjusting for a brighter light. Okay, but anyway, you can see that we have a lot of things going on in our eye, and then all of these cells combine their signals, send them to our visual cortex in our brain, and we have to be able to figure out the colors that we are viewing, and this is done largely by the processing in our brain. And so we get a variety of wavelengths that are visible to us, all the way from 400 nanometers all the way up to just about, 675 or so, which represents the spectrum of visible light that we can see. So color perception, this isn't the easiest thing in the world. It's difficult. It's not only difficult for us to understand how it works biologically, but it's also difficult for us to understand when we're viewing colors. And I say this because our brains play tricks on us. We don't see things the way they might actually exist in the real world. And I have a couple of fun examples to show you that prove this. So some optical illusions here. How many of you have seen this before? Oh, good, not many. So don't spoil it for the rest of us. But this is a particularly neat one. You'll notice that there is, say, a tile floor, and there's some cylinder resting on it. There's a light on the far right casting a shadow of that cylinder onto the tile floor. And you'll notice that two of the tiles in particular are labeled A and B. A way up here, B right here. Now, the neat thing about this optical illusion is that it's not really as it seems. So what is going on here is that the tile color A is exactly the same as the tile color B. And this is, it's messing with our minds, because we perceive this shadow here and we assume that it shouldn't be any lighter, or any darker, but it looks the same. I mean, it looks lighter, but it's actually the same. Okay, you don't believe me, so watch this. Okay, here, so I have this. All right, that's the slide. And what I'm going to do is bring up a color meter, which you might have seen me use before. And all it does is you can see that it provides a list of values I'll do it in actual value. So you might recognize this as being red, green, and blue values, and a value of 0 through 255 for each. So this is a very quantifiable way of determining a color. So if I put it over this big block of red, you can see that it is predominantly red, makes perfect sense. Do I have anything that's nice and green over here? You can see it's predominantly green. Okay, so let's do this for A. So you'll notice that I have my mouse right over the A tile, and it says that it is about kind of a middle gray, all 139s for these values. Now if I move down here, you'll notice that it says the exact same thing for B. Okay, there might still be some of you that are skeptical, because I know I didn't believe this at first either. So what I'm going to try to do next, if this will work for me, oh, come on. What I'm going to try to do next, if this works, is try to bring this same image into Photoshop, and then we will try to do a modification to it that will hopefully make it a little bit more obvious. Oops. All right, so we have here, so it did something to the green color, but you can see that the optical illusion remains the same. And what I'm going to do is grab, let's see, place the file. I'm going to grab the eyedropper and record the color of that A slot. And so if I bring up the color meter, you'll see that it did pick that all 139 gray that we saw before. And then what I'm going to do is just paint like a little bit of a, let's see, I'll just draw a rectangle from A to B. And I will fill this rectangle with that gray if this works. Oh, this is stupid. Smart, well, let's see. Try this again. That's stupider. Oh, this is okay. All right, so here I have just filled it completely with that color. Now that there's this color bridge, you can actually see that they are the same color, but still it is playing a trick on our mind. And so the reason that this works is that you'll notice that there's these tiles here. So this is the dark tile in the section that does not have a shadow, and the shadow makes this dark tile get darker, and this what was previously a light tile now was, I mean, they just use the same color as the dark tile here, but because our eyes are used to, or our brains are used to seeing this pattern of dark and light and dark and light, it tricks us into looking at this in a very, very different way. Okay. Well, I always like that one. I think that's fun. But I have even yet another optical illusion to destroy your brain with. Okay, so as soon as my computer comes back up. Okay, now I'm going to show you a picture. This is a picture that I took a long time ago. And I want you to stare at the black dot at the very center. And I promise nothing scary, you know, nothing's going to jump out of the screen. Nothing stupid or scary is going to happen. This is a legitimate optical illusion. And so I want you to stare at this. I'm going to talk about stuff for about 30 seconds while you stare at this. And what you will see when I change the slide, you may not actually notice that I had changed the slide, you probably will, but the slide will, it will be the same image, but the slide itself is going to have a slightly different color tint to it. And so it is this that I want you to pay attention to. And so somehow I managed to talk for 30 seconds without actually saying anything. So I'm going to switch to the next slide now. Okay, close your eyes, shake your head a little bit, and look at the slide again. Do you see what happened? So you saw for a brief second the inverse color. You saw the correct color for this image, which was a red building and a blue sky, when before you'd just been staring at the inverse, and then I flipped it over to this black and white, or this gray representation. And the reason that this works is that our eyes, or our cells, the cells in our eyes respond to various stimuli. So if there's a very strong predominance of a particular color, our eyes will try to battle that, and it'll get used to it, very much like our bodies get used to pretty much any substance or any sort of stimulus we are able to ignore after a little while. The same sort of thing happens in our eyes. And so when we switch to this black and white one, we see the inverse of that color that had that it existed before. So I made this a few years ago, and I used to know how to do this, and I think it's pretty easy. I think all you have to do is you just take an image into Photoshop. You literally take the inverse of the colors, which is pretty easy. It's like, at least on the Mac, it's like an Apple. I think it's the key Apple I, and then on a Windows machine, it's probably Control I or Alt I or something like that. And then you save that as a file. You put a black dot in the center. Then you just convert it to black and white and do the same thing. Put the black dot in the center. You'll be able to amaze and your friends, just as I have done, hopefully, to most of you. Okay. So we can perceive a gamut of colors. So we can see not only the sort of pure blues, pure greens, and pure reds, but also a lot of these colors in between. And for those of you that start working with color or get interested in color management and start talking or and start working with this, you might start to recognize this particular type of graph. And so in this graph, this is just a representation of something called a color space, which all it is saying is just a representation of available colors. So in this color space, for example, this is representing all of the colors that we can see with our eyes. So we can see all the way from this very deep blue, which is at about this wavelength of 380 nanometers. We just go all the way around. So this very outside edge of this color space represents the individual colors that we can see with our eyes. And so there's an important thing that I have to mention here that this outside line represents, and that is that these colors are, if you were to imagine something, some source of light that was only capable of producing that one frequency of light. So let's say a red laser, for example, is able to produce something along somewhere around here. So most of the light that we see, such as coming from our computer screens or from the lights or even from the sun in the sky, doesn't produce monochromatic color. It's not one color that it produces. It produces usually a range of colors, and it is that we see normally in day-to-day life. But if we want to produce individual colors, that is sort of the most saturated version of these colors that you can imagine. So it's not the same thing to look at this on this projector, because I'm sure that even in your mind you can imagine that this blue, for example, you can imagine a blue that's much more saturated, or this green at the far upper left-hand corner that's much more green. It just looks much more saturated. This is supposed to represent that. This isn't saying, okay, this is, you just have to imagine that all of the brightest of the bright colors that you can see is along that outside edge. And that's all that this is really trying to represent. Now we can start to combine those. So if you imagine that we have this very, very, it doesn't even have to be bright. I'm just talking about very strong in color, very saturated red laser, for example, nothing that's very bright, something like this. Then you have another one, maybe a blue laser, for example, and it's over here. You combine the two, so you point the two at the same point, and it combines the light to be this purplish light. You can actually draw a line between those two points and the one right in the middle. That's that color that will be represented. So what we're showing here is this capability of mixing various colors to get all of the colors that we can perceive, just, you know, period. Everything that we can see and perceive is supposed to be represented by this graph. Now you might be wondering why it's shown like this, why there's an x-axis, why there's a y-axis. Just very briefly for your interest, I don't think it's very important, but they put along the x-axis something called chromaticity, and then they put along the y-axis the luminance, so how bright something will appear. So from that respect, this might make a little bit more sense, and this is certainly what we have talked about. Blue will be the least luminant, red will be next, and then at the very top will be green. Okay, so we can represent white, for example, by mixing all of these colors together. At the very center, we will get sort of this white light that we can imagine. Okay, so just remember that along the outside is this monochromatic light, something that is produced, that is capable of producing that wavelength and only that wavelength, and that is what we are taking a look at. Now, because we are looking at, say, a computer screen, or because we are looking at a projector, either of these devices are not capable of producing the entire color range that's available to us for viewing. So it's going to be some smaller subset within this that a computer or a projector will be able to display to us. And so you can imagine that in order for a computer display to work, so as you know, or as you might know, most computer displays work by having very, very small dots. So especially the LCDs that we have now, they have, you know, very small pixels on them, a red pixel, a green pixel, and a blue pixel. And then it's the combination of these pixels that will produce all of the colors that we are able to see on the computer screen. Now, these screens, though, aren't perfect. They're not able to make a perfectly monochromatic color. It's usually something a little bit inside. And even though we have a red pixel over here, a blue pixel over here, and a green pixel over here, it's going to be much smaller than that. So we can imagine that we're going to have this triangle in here of sorts that represents all of the colors that are possible. And a lot of the color spaces even that we talk about over time work in the same way. So there's a few color spaces that we've at least alluded to in the past, and one of them is RGB or sRGB, and this is sort of the default, the de facto color space that you will be using when you are publishing your photos on the web or when you will be displaying them on a computer screen. Basically, anything that is not going to go to print, you will use sRGB. That is because this is very, very common, and it's supported by pretty much all digital cameras. It's supported by pretty much all computers. It's supported by pretty much all devices. So this is the way to go when you want to display accurate color on a computer screen or on a projector, for example. And so it defines in the sRGB space these maximums. So there will be this maximum blue over here. There'll be this maximum red over here. There's this maximum green over here. And the center of which is this white. And they just called this white D65. I don't know why it's called that. It seems pretty arbitrary to me. But just realize that it's called this, D65. That represents that exact amount of white. So there's not this sort of color cast to it. It's not a yellowish white. It's not a reddish white. It's not a greenish white. It's just white. That is what they're calling white. Okay. Now, to make this a little bit more tangible, imagine what you've learned up until this point in terms of pixels in, say, a JPEG file. So a JPEG file, as you know, is for one pixel, is made up of a red component, green components, and a blue component, with numbers ranging from 0 to 255 for each, right? But how does the computer know what each of those values mean? Like, how does it know when you say 255 for red, 0 for green, 0 for blue, how does it know which of these reds that value means? That is what this color space is trying to solve. It's saying very definitively that a value of 255 for red and 0 for everything else is going to be this color right here. It's a known color, and your computer should therefore be able to display that value to you. The idea here is that you'll be able to go from computer to computer to device to device, a variety of other devices, and you'll be able to see the same color for your photograph on each. Now, of course, that's rarely the case, and I mean, part of the problem is that all of this stuff is complicated, and color management is not an easy thing. Pretty much everybody, except people who really care about photography, ignore it, and that is what we are trying to solve today. So how you can make your photos look color accurate, not only for yourself, now that you will soon know and understand what this stuff means, but also for your friends who maybe you don't want to have to send this lecture to and make them sit 2 hours through a color management lecture and fiddle with settings on their particular computer. So most computers will be able to display this somewhat kind of sort of accurately, and that is what this is doing. So again, if you think of a photo, you can think of it as a large paint by numbers picture. So you have this very large photo. It's represented by pixels, and each pixel has a number associated with each. But until you know what each number is supposed to represent in terms of the color, you're not going to be able to paint that picture correctly. It's not going to have the correct color. Now, you can imagine that for a paint-by-numbers picture, you could go really crazy and like swap blues and reds if you really didn't know. You'll generally get, like, if it's supposed to be red, you'll generally see it as being red. I'm not talking about that sort of craziness, but I'm talking about like how bright, or how rather how saturated that red is, whether it's sort of a muddy, brownish, purplish red, or whether it's a more accurate, like, red. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So sRGB, this is very, very common. This is what you should be using for anything that's destined for, say, Flickr, for your website, when you're emailing your friends, your family. This is what you should be using. Now, if you're going to be destining your photograph for print, you have to use a different color space. And so I just want to draw your attention to really quickly to this screen as I change the slide, because you will see the difference from the sRGB color space to the Adobe RGB color space. And you'll see that this one now extends a ways into the green section, whereas the sRGB color space definitely underrepresented the greens that we are capable of seeing. The Adobe RGB color space is able to represent a lot more green. And so it will look more accurate, especially for any landscape shots, anything where you have a predominance of green within the photograph. It will be displayed, you might say, more accurately by Adobe RGB. But this doesn't mean that if you are taking a photo that is outside or of something that's green, that you should switch your camera to Adobe RGB, because it's going to cause problems when you send it to your friends and they are only on an sRGB computer. So when they are viewing images and they're expecting those images to be sRGB, and most of our computers by default are expecting these photographs to be displayed in sRGB. And so it's the same thing with the same concept of painting by numbers. We still have the same number of values available to us. So we have 255 for red, 255 for green, 255 for blue. But what we're saying with this change in color space is that value 255 for green represents a green that's way up there, much more saturated than what was 255, that same value in RGB. And that's why I'm saying if you take a photograph or you process it in Adobe RGB and it has a lot of greens in it and you're like, wow, this looks amazing, and you send it to your friends and it doesn't look that good, that's the reason, is that you're doing this conversion that may not be done very well and will be confusing to look at. Okay, so we're talking about having to do this sort of conversion, or being able to look at photographs with the same color across a multitude of devices. And that is exactly what color management tries to allow us to do. So what we can do is we can import an image, you know, whether it be by a scanner, from an image file, from a digital camera. It comes in with these known values, and it will have a profile associated with it. So whereas right here, so what we were talking about previously were color spaces, you can imagine that there is this other concept of profiles. So to make this more concrete, you know that when you look at one computer and you go home to your computer and then maybe you go over to a friend's house and see a third computer still, that colors tend to just look ever so slightly different across each of these computers. So even if you're looking at the same web page or you're looking at the same image across all of these machines, they might look a little bit differently. And the reason for this is that the monitor is just, it's not able to display those colors very accurately. And that is what this concept of a profile is trying to overcome. So whereas we have a working color space right in the middle that defines exactly, you know, how saturated each of these colors should be, it defines exactly which color it should be, that is only half the picture. The other half is being able to apply these profiles to these devices whether it be a scanner, whether it be a printer, whether it be a computer monitor, which tells the computer how to represent, it will say, okay, well, I know that I can represent colors from here to here to here, and this is how you do it. It tells the computer how to be able to replicate these colors that it wants to replicate. And so only by using a color management workflow that includes properly profiled devices, so by default, I'm sure most of your cameras will be properly profiled, but your laptop or your desktop computer monitor is what I'm referring to mostly here. If it is not profiled correctly, what the color space is telling the computer to print as this blue right here, your computer might completely mess up. And it might be a very ever so slightly different shade of blue, but just enough that if you were to print out that photo or if you were to send it to one of your friends, it would look very different. It would look very different to you, even if it's just ever so slightly shifted. So what we are attempting to do with these profiles is to know what the scanner or the printer or the monitor is able to reproduce in terms of its particular color. And so by having this profile, the computer then is able to apply this profile to the color space, and you will be able to see the image in the color you expect. Now, at this point, realize that we're talking about very subtle differences in color, but enough that it would be annoying or even discouraging as photographers of at our particular level, where we're able to discern these differences. And this can be a big problem for us and frustrating if we're working on a photo and we work hard to get it just right and we print it out and the colors don't look the same. That is precisely what this whole thing is trying to do. Okay, so just to give you an idea, it just so happens that Max, in addition to being able to show us or having that very fancy color meter application that's over here, it also does a pretty good job of displaying to us a variety of profiles that are available as well. So I just want to show you, for example, an sRGB profile. Oops. Let me show you in the one that you are familiar with. Okay. So here, realize that this is a graph of the colors that are possible from, so it looks slightly different. All right, well, this is going to be the closest one. So this is sort of a similar graph to what we were seeing in the slides. So we have, you imagine that there's the y-axis and the x-axis, and this is that line that goes around. And so when we're viewing sRGB of all of the possible colors that are available to us, this is that sRGB color space. Now, just to give you an example, I can hold this for comparison, and then I can show a profile for my monitor. And so you can see now the difference in from what my monitor is expecting to be able to show versus what RGB is wanting us to show. So if I have a photo that's tagged with an sRGB color space, then we would expect to see colors in this range of that outlined white triangle. But my monitor on this particular laptop is only capable of showing me colors in this range, from here to here to here to here. In fact, this is a problem of laptop monitors. They have a very limited, what's called gamut. And a gamut is basically how many colors it can show. Laptop monitors, portable device monitors, are very, very bad at showing you a good or a wide gamut. And you usually have to go to expensive, not even that expensive, but decent desktop monitors to be able to represent a lot of the colors. And in fact, for those of you that may have been dealing with digital photography in the past, you may know that when there was this big push from the change from the large CRT monitors, remember the big ones that would take up your whole desk, to these thinner ones, all of the professionals were saying, no, I'm staying with my CRT monitor The reason for that is that they got so good that they had a much wider gamut of colors that was much more accurate than LCDs. And now LCDs are just barely sort of catching up with, well, maybe not even that. Maybe in the past couple of years, they've been caught up with the CRT monitors of about 10 years ago. But for a while, there was this sort of awkward phase in LCD technology where it just was not as color accurate, or it just was not as possible to show us good saturated colors that a file wanted us to show. So there is something perilous about using only a laptop to do color work, and that is that it's not going to be exact. There's going to be a little bit of a shift in color, and I mean that's fine. If that's all you have, that's certainly fine. It's not going to be a deal breaker, but it's something to be aware of, especially if you are interested in forming your own sort of photography business where color becomes, you know, of the utmost importance. You may not be able to use your laptop unless it has a very, very good, very, very good screen. Okay, so just to give you an example, I'll click on some of these other ones. So here is a printer, for example, and you'll see that it's kind of oddly shaped. It's much more bulbousy. The reason for that is that it has inks. And so this printer in particular might have maybe 5 inks or 6 inks or something like that. And it's capable of producing colors in sort of these outside regions, but when you combine them all together, it's still not very good. And so there's a lot of, I mean, you can look at a variety of profiles and see how they compare to the sRGB color space, but just realize that by my clicking on this, it's not actually affecting the color of anything. I'm just using this for informational purposes, just to show you the differences in these profiles versus some of these working spaces. So just to give you an idea, so NTSC, this is, if you're not familiar, NTSC is used for color encoding of televisions, and it's gone all the way back since the early 50s, I think. And it can encode a huge gamut of colors, and it's sort of funny because a lot of monitors, even today, just are incapable of showing all of the colors that this color space is supposed to be able to show us. And in fact, you can see underneath just how small this sRGB color space is compared to this much larger NTSC space. So when you're looking at a monitor, it might be rated in terms of percentage of NTSC or something like that. That's usually telling you how many colors of this NTSC space it is capable of producing. It's a marketing term, but they're using it as sort of a goal. They want to get to, you know, being able to display all of these colors that are possible. Okay, so let's just take a look at some other ones. Let's see, where is Adobe RGB? It's got to be up here. All right, so here you can see that it sort of made the other one disappear. So let me do this the opposite way. Hold that, and then I'll click on sRGB. And so you can see now just how much larger the Adobe RGB space is compared to sRGB. Okay, so what we are trying to do, as a quick reminder, is we have these colors and we're trying to represent them with numbers, literally, by values in a computer, and we need some way of doing that. And that is what this profile is able to do. It says, okay, for a number 255, you should have this value printed out, or you should have this value shown on your screen. And then even more abstract from that is this color space idea, where we are able to move a file that has a color space built into it from one computer to another, and we can say, okay, this value, this red should appear this way on this screen, and then the computer uses the profile to be able to show the value correctly on the computer screen. Now, as you can imagine, and as you saw, we have a variety of color spaces for us to work with. And sometimes we have to convert from one color space to another. And so this is a process that's called gamut mapping. And there's two major ways of being able to do this. So one is perceptual, and the other, and I always butcher how to pronounce this, is colorimetric. Oh, I think I did it. Nice. Okay. All right, so we have perceptual and colorimetric. And the way that each of these work is different. So imagine that we have an image and it has a wide variety of colors from reds and greens. We want to change that image from an Adobe RGB color space, cram it into an sRGB color space. Now realize that what we're doing, this act of compressing, as it looks like it's compressing, it's not actually changing the values in the image. I want that to be very, very clear. When we have an image and we have a green pixel and it is a, you know, red is 0, green is 255, and blue is 255, and we're converting how that color is going to appear from one space to another space, we're not changing the value, we're only changing the color space. And the color space, as you know, is going to be oh man, I completely blanked on what I was talking about. So what was I talking about? Somebody help me out here. All right, so I started thinking about something else, and then I was like, wow, that's really interesting, and then I completely forgot what my mouth was doing, and so I lost it. Okay, yes? Okay. Yes. So that's a multifaceted question, and it's one that I think I can better answer especially in the next hour when we start talking about more of the workflow, like the how to do this stuff. So right now this is sort of the theory behind all of this stuff, and then as we start talking about how this actually applies to Photoshop and to our workflow, then I hope that will become a little bit more clear. So let me address that. Maybe in the next hour when we start talking more in more detail about this. Yes?
Maybe the workflow will help clarify my confusion as well. Mm-hmm. But my question is, what's the sense of converting? Are these profiles linked to the output of however you're looking at the image?
Yes, so the reason that we have to convert this sometimes is that we might have... we might have an image that has one color space. So for example, we might have an image that is in the Adobe RGB color space, and we want to be able to post that image online for general consumption. And we shouldn't publish that photo in Adobe RGB color space. We should convert it to an sRGB color space, and then we will have, because that will allow the best opportunity for us to display color accurately from one computer to another.
Dan, my question is, Adobe RGB has a larger color space. Mm-hmm. So if you're posting that online, mm-hmm. and if the screen itself only supports the sRGB, wouldn't it just maximize the Adobe RGB space?
Maximize the Adobe RGB space.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't the Adobe RGB just maximize the space that the screen allows because that space is smaller than the Adobe RGB?
Well, this is also a complex question because some web browsers, as we'll see in the second half, actually completely ignore color management, and the values that are associated with an image, and those values are supposed to represent some known color. After you apply this color space and after you apply the profile, it's just completely disregarded by a very annoying browser, Internet Explorer in particular. And so it looks wrong. And so you, in order to combat this, you have to convert these images to what would be into the color space that a non-color managed browser would support by default. So just because it's displaying on a screen, it's most likely going to show an sRGB color space. An Adobe RGB file will appear incorrectly on a screen if it is not correctly color managed. And again, I have that's a question that I also will be answering in the second half when there's a very neat web page that shows the differences between color-managed browsers, non-color-managed browsers, and a lot of this other information. Okay, so back to gamut mapping. So we have a couple of different ways of converting an image's colors from one color space to another. So we could do perceptual, and the short of it is that if you're a photographer, perceptual is generally the way you're going to want to go, because you're not going to want to just get rid of extra images that exist within a particular image, because it will just clip the rest of the images. So it's as if you have lost details in the highlights, so to speak, but you've lost detail in the extremity of that particular color gamut, and it's literally changing some values. And so, just to give you an idea, and just to demystify some of this information for you, I want to show you the color settings that in Photoshop that are generally a good way to start out. So, for the newer versions of Photoshop, you go to the Edit menu. Edit menu, and then color settings. When you click on that, it brings up this color settings window, and you see that there's a variety of options available here. So, basing the settings off of just the typical North America General Purpose 2, that applies sort of a baseline level of settings. But what's important is this working spaces section, and we'll talk about why it's important to set this. So hopefully it'll become more clear in the next hour. But for RGB, which I'm sure most of you will actually be working with, I recommend setting that to sRGB. And so you'll notice that sRGB has this additional tag, IEC 61966-2.1. It's just a revision number, but sRGB and sRGB IEC 61966-2.1 are used interchangeably, so you can consider them the same thing. Okay. So I recommend that you leave sRGB as your working space. This means that new files that you create will be in this working space, and that it just makes it easier for you to deal with. And the reason for this is that if you are destining most of your photos for the web, as I do, then sRGB is the way to go. Now, CMYK, this is just the default, I think. If you're doing professional level printing, which uses four colors, then you might have to change your working space to CMYK to be able to get the best color available. Gray and spot, that's just the default as well. So what's really important is that RGB, I think. Now, if you're going to be doing a lot of printing on your own, then you might want to change this color space to Adobe RGB. Now, remember that this is dangerous because by default, you'll be creating documents and files in the Adobe RGB color space. And you shouldn't be sending those documents or those files to your friends, because the colors will look weird. You have a better chance of having good color with an sRGB color space. Okay, now this is also really, really important. The color management policies. When we open a file that has a working space that is different than our working space above, so we currently in Photoshop have a working space of sRGB. That means most of the documents that we are working with or creating are in sRGB. But when we open a file that maybe has a different color space, like Adobe RGB, for example, these are the settings that apply to that. So what happens when I open that file? And by default, you must be preserving the embedded profiles. This ensures that when you open the file, it will be able to tell Photoshop, so to speak, though it's kind of the other way around, it tells Photoshop what the colors are, and Photoshop will be able to display those colors accurately. Most people get annoyed with all of the color management warnings when you open up a file and there's a color mismatch or something like that, and they tend to turn this off. But don't do that. If you disable color management in Photoshop, then you're just destroying all of this work that we're trying to establish today. You're just not going to have good, well-defined color from one file to the next. So don't turn this off. Preserve the embedded profiles. Now, profile mismatches, for some reason on this computer, I don't have these on, but on the computer where I actually work, I do actually have it ask me when it's opening what to do with those profiles. And this, a profile mismatch is the one that I referenced before, where if I'm opening a file This file has an embedded color profile of Adobe RGB, and Photoshop has a working color space of sRGB, then what am I supposed to do? And that is, I have it ask me what to do, because usually I know a little bit about the file, a little bit of the context of the file and what I should be doing with that color profile. And most of the time, though, you will just want to preserve the embedded profiles, especially if you're just opening photos within Photoshop. Okay, so conversion, these are the defaults. So it uses the Adobe engine. This is what happens when you're converting from one color space to the next. I do recommend perceptual, the intent being perceptual. That's that gamut mapping change, because it maintains the gradients within the colors rather than just chopping off, you know, extraneous colors that you might have when mapping from an Adobe RGB color space to an sRGB color space. Use dither, that's just a way of it trying to simulate the colors that existed in other color profiles. So that's the color settings within Photoshop. And so I think piece by piece, we're starting to put some of this together. But for us to really understand it, we'll have to look at some examples. And in order for us to do that, we have to take a 5-minute break. Welcome back, everyone. Okay, so before the break, we were talking about gamut mapping. And I made sort of a fool of myself when I was trying to talk about this stuff, and I lost my place mid-sentence pretty embarrassing. Okay, so I wrote down what I intend to say, and I'm going to read it to you. Okay, so we have two different types of gamut mapping. We have perceptual and colorimetric. Now, perceptual, as I said, is best for pictures because it maintains the full gamut. So there's no loss of colors that are outside of a smaller gamut that may have existed in a larger gamut. These full gradients still exist. They're just compressed, so to speak. Okay, so colorimetric, on the other hand, this is better used when you are trying to view something on your screen and you want the color that is supposed to be in in this file to be represented very accurately by your screen. So whereas here, this would actually compress the colors from a wide gamut down to a smaller gamut, what we are doing is we are going to allow in colorimetric, we're going to allow this region of the gamut to be displayed or rendered very, very accurately. So we use colorimetric typically when displaying images that have to have, you know, very precise color on screen. And so as you may recall, the gamut of a particular screen might be smaller than the gamut of say Adobe RGB. And so what we might do typically then is use colorimetric to be able to display the colors that are on screen very accurately, and then just have the knowledge that there are other colors that might be clipped, or as we would see in, say, when we clip some highlights in a digital photograph, we might have additional colors here that just are not being represented by the screen. Okay, so we have this idea that we need to be able to profile our devices. So not only our cameras, which come kind of profiled by default, but also our monitors, and most importantly, our monitors. So many of you, if not all of you, have probably not profiled your monitor to have accurate color. And this is important to do to be able to accurately display all of the colors within this particular slide. So let's see. So just looking at it, and it's probably better seen elsewhere, one of the most obvious ways of seeing if your monitor is not properly profiled is to take a look at a grayscale, basically just a grayscale, to see if there are any color casts within it. So we know that this should be white, gray, darker gray, darker gray, darker gray, black. Well, this is black, but this is a very dark gray. And if you look at it and you see any color casts, and they're usually in the form of like a very slight amount of green or a very slight amount of magenta, and I think you can sort of see a slight green cast here, though my eyes might be playing tricks on me being this close, you know that your profiler, in this case the projector, is not properly profiled and it is not displaying this color accurately on the screen. And so it's harder for us to notice when it's something is not properly profiled in these other colors, but it's very obvious to us, especially when it's grayscale. But this is representative of the problems that can exist throughout the color spectrum and all of the colors that you might have on screen. And so there's a variety of ways that we can profile our monitors. We can go to a store or to Amazon.com or just any photographic or just any store where you can buy some photo stuff and buy a hardware profile. So what you can do with some of these hardware profiles is it's like a looks like a little hockey puck. You stick it onto your screen and it displays some, there's some software that this puck communicates, or rather the other way around, the software communicates with this puck and it displays a color on the screen. The puck is responsible for reading that color, and then it will know if that color is slightly off versus what it should be. And then the software then will go through a whole series of colors and scales from white to dark, for example, and it will create a profile for your monitor. You can then load that profile into your computer, and it's actually surprisingly easy. For those of us with Macs, and that's just because I happen to have one right here, you can just load up the system preferences, go into displays, and it's all under color. These are the profiles when it comes up. These are the profiles that I have for this particular monitor. Now, I've been bad on this computer, but because I don't do any editing on this particular machine, I haven't actually profiled this, so I only have the default color LCD profile. But if I had one of these hardware pucks and I was able to create a profile for this laptop, then I would be able to create one, load it here. You can see there's an open profile button. It makes it very easy. And all of the colors will just magically be rendered correctly, assuming you have a proper color management workflow. So assuming that you're using the correct color space, et cetera, for the image as it was displayed or as it was created. Okay, so there's that route. And usually the hardware profilers really range in price. You might see them somewhere from like $100 to way expensive, like $1,000 of worth of profiling. But those things can typically do stuff like profile projectors, profile printers, and be able to do it's very all-inclusive color management solution. So for those of us where we're just doing stuff on the web, then we probably don't need to spend all that much. And in fact, it is possible to do color profiling with software as well. So just using software and our eyeballs, we can try to create a color profile that closely matches what should be accurate. So you'll notice that very conveniently here, there's a calibrate button. So for those of us that have Macs, we have this calibrate button. For those of you on Windows, you will probably have to download some color calibration software. And there's freebies available online that color management websites recommend and be able to do some tests. And so what happens is you click on that, and I'm not going to actually do it because this takes, if you're being careful, this can take you a good amount of time. But you typically see something like this, and they're very cute. They put a little apple in the center, but usually it's just a square or something like that. And you have adjacent to it these lines that alternate from black to white. And the whole point of this is that you got to kind of squint your eyes at it a little bit and try to blend the color. And so what you want to do is adjust the brightness and the darkness of this center part. So as you can see, it's not happening on, all right, I'm doing it on the wrong, I'm doing it on the color LCD and not on the projector. So let me do this on the projector instead, where this will become more obvious. So now you can actually see how it's modifying the contrast of the screen itself. Okay, so I'm squinting and you just got to kind of eyeball it. And if there's any color cast, you can use this tool. You can see that it's placing different color casts on the gray, trying to correct that particular thing. So just guessing, this looks kind of right. And you have to do this for a lot of different shades of gray. And your eyes get really tired because you're like this, sitting at your computer, and oh, it's such a pain. You can't open your eyes anymore. It's really terrible. Okay, we'll talk about this in just a second. But when you're profiling your monitor, this will just help you remove any additional color cast. And in fact, I did kind of a bad job because to me it looks like now this white I don't think this is a result of me messing with it, but it could have just been this way before. this just looks sort of yellow to me. It has sort of a yellow color cast, and it just doesn't look correct. Now, when you're doing profiling, there's a few things that you have to keep in mind. If you're using an LCD, this is probably the most difficult aspect of the profiling. If you're doing software profiling on an LCD, you have to be very careful that you are sitting at the exact height and looking at it in the exact way that you will normally be doing it. Because as I'm sure you've noticed, especially with laptops, when you are looking at something, and I don't know if I can do this safely, it actually will change the color cast depending on the angle that you're looking at the screen. And this is really bad. This is one of the reasons why LCDs are not necessarily the best for you know, very good color management, because as soon as you start slouching because you get tired and you look at it at a different angle, the colors are different, and this is bad and this is annoying. So when you're really squinting at this and trying to get it right, I noticed what happened to me was that I was doing this and I changed how I was looking at the LCD ever so slightly, and then I looked at it and it looked horrible, and I'm like, oh damn it. So I had to go back and do it again and sit up straight and squint, and it was bad. Okay. So anyway, make sure it is at the correct angle when you are doing this software profiling on your computer. Now, one of the things that I do want to mention is to continue this idea of color management software. So there's software that supports color management, and there's software that doesn't support color management. And the software that does support color management will read a file, and it will know that embedded somewhere inside of this file is a description of the color space. And so it knows just by reading this file, okay, this file should be read with sRGB, or this file should be read with Adobe RGB, and it will therefore know how to process and display those images on screen. But one of the most obvious pieces of software that traditionally are very, very, very bad about color management are web browsers. And just to give you an example, I have to use this computer that is a Windows machine to be able to show you best. Oh, come on. All right, good. Okay, so there's this website that's linked to off of the course webpage. And this guy loves to use funky text colors and lots of caps and all sorts of stuff. But if you read it, this actually has very, very good information about color management and color management software. Now, I want you to take a look, so I'm gonna scroll down a little bit. So this is, keep in mind, a Windows machine running specifically Internet Explorer. And Internet Explorer, if you're not familiar, well, if you're using it, stop using it. It is, it's terrible, it sucks. And this is just one reason why. If you take another class that I'm involved with, Computer Science E75, Building Dynamic Websites, you have to create websites that work across multiple browsers, and only then do you really get the feeling of the frustration that can exist between the differences in these browsers. So I'm going to try not to go into too long of a rant because this stuff is important, but Internet Explorer is bad, is very, very bad. And Firefox is very good, Safari is very good, and just download one of those and use them. All Internet Explorer is good for, I saw this quote somewhere online, all Internet Explorer is good for is downloading Firefox. And really, that's very, very true. Okay, so on this web page, there are a variety of images. And these images are just used to show you, it's just meant to show you a variety of colors, a whole range of colors, and it's supposed to appear somewhat accurately. Now, in an image, we can either have an image that is tagged for a particular color space, which means that browser will then display those colors correctly, or we can actually strip the profile out of the image, so there is no color profile embedded into the image. That means that the web browser, or really any application that has to deal with color management, has to make an assumption about what those values for the colors mean, right? So it's as if it is getting a paint by numbers, and it is making a guess as to which paint applies to each number, versus a profile which will tell it this paint applies to this number, this paint applies to this number. Okay, so we have a tagged and an untagged file. Now, what's neat about this website is that this guy took those two files, there's a tagged file and an untagged file, and he laid them on top of each other, and by hovering your mouse over the image, you can just quickly see both of them. So maybe I should switch back to the to how we do this properly really quick. So just to show you what this would look like on a web browser such as Firefox that can properly do it, we have a tagged RGB photo and it looks like this. Then when I hover my mouse, it's going to remove the tag. It's going to be a file that has no tag, and you can see it looks different. Okay, so I'll do that again. Tagged, untagged. And you can see that there's this difference in color. The reason is that the browser for the untagged image has to guess. And so it's just going to apply probably sRGB with the monitor profile and just show you what it thinks those values should be based on that assumption. Okay, so showing a tagged image, then you can see that a color managed browser will show you that image properly. This looks better. This looks correct. And this is an example of what I was telling you before, how it's not necessarily a deal breaker because you can still see the image, but it's an annoyance. That color is not right compared to the tagged image. So color management, this is proof of concept of color management, but also this is proof that using a color managed browser is very important. And again, to make fun of Internet Explorer, okay, we have a tagged image right here, untagged. It looks exactly the freaking same, and it's annoying. This should be very different, but it's not. It is exactly the same. And so Internet Explorer fails as a color managed application, and it ignores whatever profile is embedded into the file, and it just applies whatever paints, so to speak, it thinks it needs to be applied to those numbers or to those values that are within the image. So I recommend that you take a look at this image or at this website and try to work through it, because it is actually really interesting, if a little bit dense, but you will get a better understanding for color management, why it is important, and how it can apply to applications and to web browsers itself. So here, normally in an image, it would look normal, like this image of the baby and the children and all this other stuff that's up there. But just to give you a really crazy example of why color management is important, we can see this image. So here what he did was he actually created an image, and I should again show you what it should look like. He gives us an image that is properly tagged. So it might have a number, so this value for red, for example, but then there's some value within it that represents that red, but then there's this profile inside of this file that says, okay, this value actually represents this color, okay? So when we have a properly color managed application, we see these colors as we expect them. But if we remove this tag, if we remove that section within this file that tells us what color or what value should represent red, what color should represent cyan, then we see this mess. We see that what should be red is actually blue, what should be green is actually red. And this is just an extreme example, but it does show us why color management is important, because if we do not have the capability for a color managed application, then no matter what we do, we are going to see the incorrect colors on this web page. So again, this is over exaggerated, and the one at the very top, this is more correct to what we would actually see. Okay, now along with our discussion of color management, there's also something else that's very important that we have to talk about, and that is the fact that computers as well apply a tone curve to the display, to everything that is being displayed on screen. And this tone curve, we call it something completely different, and it's called a gamma curve. And so there is a value called gamma that basically defines how contrasty this image, or how contrasty a particular screen or a particular monitor is. Now you'll hear a variety of numbers. The most popular ones are these four up here, with the last two, 1.8 and 2.2, the most popular. Now, if you are doing anything remotely, let's see, if you are doing something really very professional, like you are going to send your files to a prepress, you're going to be working with Adobe RGB, you're going to be doing very professional level prints, then you might consider using gamma 1.8. This was the default gamma for Macintosh computers all the way up through and including OS 10.5. So those of you that know Macs probably know what I'm talking about. But in 10.6, and for all of the PCs out there today, we use a gamma value of 2.2. And I suspect that this is why what motivated this change to a gamma level of 2.2 was that pretty much everybody uses 2.2, and Apple said, okay, well, we got to try to make it a little bit easier for people to create images that look the same across different computers. And one of the things that a display calibrator will show you is the ability to pick a gamma. So right now I'm running 10.6, the latest version, and so you can see that by default, it's targeting a gamma of 2.2 to display on the screen. But just to show you, just pay attention to this photo, and I'm going to slide the slider down to 1.8 so that you can see the difference in how it will appear. Whoa, 1.8, do you see the difference? It's ever so slightly brighter because it's less contrasty. And so this, again, is exaggerated if you view it on a screen, but this actually was, before I understood all of this stuff, this was a huge source of confusion when I had a Mac and I was posting some photos online, and I thought they looked, you know, nice. They had a good amount of contrast on them. Then when I viewed it on a friend's PC, and they looked overly contrasty. They were way too saturated, way too contrasty. This was the problem. I was running gamma 1.8. My friend was running 2.2 because he's a Windows PC, and it had much more contrast, and it looked bad. It looked terrible. And I was like, oh, crap, maybe this is why nobody pays attention to my photos, because they all look really, really contrasty. All right. So I fixed that problem, and now people look at my photos. All right, so if you are running an older version of Mac OS, this is most pertinent to you. Change your gamma to 2.2. If you're running a Windows PC, or if you're running the latest version of Mac OS, you're probably okay, but it's still probably good to check, because many PCs, especially older ones, tended to have even higher gammas because they realized that people really like that contrasty look, the punchy, colorful look of a particular machine, and so they would sometimes up the gamma a little bit. Most likely, though, if you have a somewhat modern machine, you will have a gamma of 2.2 and be okay. But this is just as vital as the rest of it. And in fact, before I even come back here, this will do a good job of showing you if you are, the same webpage will do a good job of showing you if your monitor is profiled properly at a gamma of 2.2. So unless you really know what you're doing, I really recommend gamma 2.2. And so we can see that we have a tagged Apple RGB in this case, so it's slightly different, and it has a 1.8 gamma color space. So if we remove the tag, we would expect it to look the same in a 1.8 gamma monitor, but since there is a difference, we can see that there is a change. Because there is a difference in these tagged and untagged images, we can tell that we have a properly set gamma. So this is just a way of testing the gamma on your particular machine. So again, this is a pretty interesting way of learning about color management, and also a very real and practical hands-on way of doing it. But again, to do it, you really have to be running the latest version of Firefox, or even better, Safari. And the reason for that is this. So I'm just running a standard Firefox install. And so for a while, if you were running Firefox 3, they had color management support built in, but they didn't have it turned on. And you had to go to this confusing list of preferences to be able to do it. And so somewhere in here, I searched for color management mode. You have to change one of these to some value, and then it turns it on after you restart it, something like that. It's a big mess. Luckily, in the later versions, they've corrected that. It's at least on to some degree, but there's even still a different color management test where we can see that we have some color management on, but not everything. And this is opposed to Safari, which still maintains sort of the win in terms of proper color management. It is able to, it has it on by default and is able to show us the color that we expect. So if you like Firefox, that's fine, stick with it. But if you want a color managed browser that you don't have to futz with very much, then Safari might be the way to go in that respect. Okay, any questions on this stuff so far? Yes?
Dan, just quickly, any experience yet with Chrome or any of the other browsers?
Other browsers, let's see. I think I checked this once on Opera, and I think it was color managed. I don't remember. I don't actually remember enough about the other ones. I recommend going to that G. Ballard website, the one that that has the pictures of the babies on it, and because that will, even just this first image, will be able to tell you very quickly whether or not a web browser is color managed. Chrome also, I don't actually know because I haven't. I have a PC, but I haven't downloaded it. I haven't tried it yet, so I don't know. I stick with the ones that I know would work, but you're more than welcome to test it out for yourself and see if it will work for you. Any other questions? Okay. So when we're working with images in Photoshop, generally what you want to do is you want to apply a color space for the destination for that image. So generally, if you take an image in raw format, for example, that's going to give you the widest variety of options. So you can apply different color spaces to it. So for example, you can have you can process the raw file into a JPEG file that has, say, an Adobe RGB tag. And then you might process it into a separate JPEG that has sRGB. Then you can process those separately, one destined for the web and one destined for print, then you'll be able to ensure that you have the same photo applied in the most number of places. So if that sounds like a lot of work, because it is, and you have to do adjustments to it twice, I recommend taking photos in RAW again and applying as much correction as you can before processing the RAW file. And then, because you can add quite a bit of contrast and adjust a variety of settings to get it pretty much how you want it to look, except maybe some pretty fine changes that you want to do, or even, you know, any major drastic changes in Photoshop that you want to make. And then if you really want to destine it for print, I think was the question before, and then you need to later send it to say Flickr or to somebody online, then what you might want to do is process it first in Adobe RGB because it has the larger gamut, and then you can do a convert down to a smaller gamut. So let's see. Well, this is all right. I have to do something slightly different here. I would just want to show you that there is an option on Photoshop. So if we have an image open, this one here, for example, what you can see is, let's see. I think I have to open a photo proper. I hope I have one that has let's see. All right, no, not that one. Where do I have a photo? Oh, I know where I have a photo, okay. Now, I'm just opening up a RAW file in Photoshop just so that you can see quickly some of the options that are provided to us, assuming my computer will work. All right, so you'll notice that at the very bottom of the screen, it tells me the color profile. So in this case, it's going to, once I process the file, it's going to process it into an sRGB profile. But if I click on this, I can actually modify which color profile I want it to go to. So if I was going to destine it for print primarily and then the web as a secondary means, then I would probably pick Adobe RGB, open the image just with the defaults for now, and then after several moments, because my computer is slow, I can see that I have some options available to me. Let's see, RGB, oh, I did 16 bits. Oh, this has just been one of those days where it's one thing after another. So the mistake that I made was I processed it in 16-bit. That's not what I wanted to do in this case because I'm going to just be doing a little bit of work on this particular image. All right. Now, after a little bit, I can... Let's see. I have some options here. You can see that underneath where I had color settings before, I could use assign profile or convert to profile. You almost will never use this assign to profile unless, there's very few exceptions to this, unless you are provided an image that does not have a profile built into it and you know it should. So in that case, then you might want to assign it the proper profile, but otherwise you will never use assign and you should use convert. So in this case, I've done whatever changes I need to do to this particular image. I can convert from, you can see the source space is Adobe RGB, and I can change the destination space to sRGB. And what's nice is that this provides a preview to me so that I can see sort of a before and after. But luckily, because there's not a lot of green in this particular image, there's not a very big change. So this convert will be, will go relatively well. So I want to do a perceptual change. Click OK, and then now I will have an sRGB image that I will be able to post online or do something with. Okay. Now, going back to this stuff, we do have some more stuff to talk about. So that is a lot of the color management aspect of this. And this is a very wide, there's a lot of information available. It can get very complicated, but I hope that this at least gives you an idea of somewhere where to start, or at least get a good foundation for this to be able to use or start using color management. But there is something else that we have to talk about within this color lecture as well, and that is this idea of white balance. And as you know, white balance can be applied to an image, or is applied to an image, when you take a photograph. And it basically defines, you know, the colors or the color cast that particular image will have. And so we have white balance is usually denoted by a number and then a K. And this means that it's some degrees Kelvin, which is, if you're familiar, it's actually a temperature rating. So why might we have a temperature rating for white balance? Here's it. It is very close to the temperature of the light. I heard something else. I'm sorry? Tones. The number does define the tone, but the reason for this, oh yep. Right, so even more specifically, there's this concept of if we have just this object in space. Imagine we have this very big rock in space, and we heat up this rock to some very high temperature, you know, thousands of degrees. You can imagine that this rock would become red hot, right? It glows a specific color. And as we increase the heat on this, and as this object becomes hotter and hotter and hotter, it actually, the light goes from this red down to this yellow, down to this blue, and it becomes white hot, right? So it goes from this red hot to this blue hot to this white hot. So the hotter something is, the cooler its light will be. Okay, so if that makes sense. So because of the way that we call these colors, where blue tones, or where blue is cool, green is cool, and red is warm, It's opposite, it's not intuitive. It's the opposite of what you would consider. But you can imagine that as you might know, the hotter something is, you know, it's going to give off like a bluer cast. And that is where this number comes from. It's specifically called this black body radiation temperature. And that is what this comes from. And so our sun is a black body and it produces a specific color temperature. But it emits, so there's this color temperature which just emits a spectrum of light. So it's still emitting wavelengths, but it's just where the majority of those wavelengths are. So we might have like a lot of light, for example, that peaks here in this yellow, or we might have a lot of light that peaks here in this blue. And the reason for this is that the shorter wavelengths, these 400 nanometers or even shorter, represent higher energies. So the hotter something gets, I'm getting distracted here. It's all a big tangent, and the geek in me comes out. But basically, all you have to know is that the higher the color temperature, the cooler it's going to be. So when we try to combat this, if we take a photo And we know that its color temperature of the source was about 500K, and we actually change the white balance slider to be higher, to be 9000K. It's going to combat that by making it look a little bit warmer. So So just to give you an idea, if we have here on this same sort of color space, you can see how these color temperatures fall onto a particular spectrum. And so typically, what we're used to seeing is somewhere around this. It's about 7,000 or 6,000, 6,500 Kelvin range. That's sort of daylight. That's what we consider to be white. And what we can do is we can define a color temperature. When we take a photograph, the camera by itself doesn't really understand the discrepancies in the color. So even though we are very, very good and very adept at adjusting to the various color temperatures that can exist. So for example, even though when the sun is lower in the sky, it'll be a warmer amount of light, white still looks white to us, but it doesn't to a digital camera. And that's where this white balance comes in. We have to try to compensate for that difference in color. Now, realize that we're mapping this physical property, this idea of a black body radiation and giving off all of these wavelengths, et cetera, et cetera. We're mapping it into a more complex subject because fluorescent lights, for example, and some other especially commercially available lights don't have a very even, nice spectrum to them. They have very specific amounts. They have spikes in the colors that they emit. So they might emit a lot of green, for example, and a little bit of another wavelength very right next to it. And so it's not going to always look, you know, the distribution of colors isn't always going to be like that. And so this topic is difficult, not for us so much, because it's easy for us to understand that light has different temperatures, it can be cooler or warmer, but it's difficult for a camera. And it's specifically difficult for it to determine what the white balance should be for a particular scene. And any of these artificial light sources can be very complicated and difficult for a camera to get right. And another time that it can be difficult is if you have two different light sources that emit two different color temperatures. That can also be quite difficult for us to do. Now, as you might know, when we're dealing with the raw format, we actually have the best capability of adjusting color temperature. So it's the white balance is not set in a raw file. So you can go back later and fix what your camera did wrong. So if all of the arguments before hasn't convinced you to at least try using RAW, then hopefully this will, because I'm sure there's been some times where you take a photo and its color just looks really off. It just looks horrible. And if you took it in JPEG, it's really hard to correct, and it's really hard to correct well. And in fact, it's almost impossible to do and retain the quality that you had originally. But doing it in RAW, it actually becomes very, very possible for us to do it quite well. So let's see. Just as an example, I have a couple of photos here that where the camera, I took the photo and it was either difficult for the camera to get right or it just didn't. So in this photo, for example, this is a photo of a sunset. So it has a particularly warm color. I'll have to make it a little bit brighter just so that you can see. Oh, come on. So in a few minutes, you'll see that normally what you would see is this sort of, there's some green grass down here along with some houses that you can sort of see. Hopefully it will display in a sec. No, it's, well, I can try that. I might have to make it just a little dark for a second. Okay, here, so I just made it a lot brighter, and so you can see the green. And so this is now the corrected color temperature, but please hold. Oh no. But, .. Stop being like this. You're embarrassing me. Okay. All right, so here I have a white balance adjuster up here. And I can use the original shot settings. And so, well, unfortunately, this has kind of been destroyed because I had to increase the brightness a lot. But before, as it was originally shot, the green area was not actually green at all. It was overcompensating for the huge amounts of color that were available in the sky. And so I actually had to modify the color temperature to be able to do it. Now, what's neat is that you can, most of the time when you take a picture in RAW, you can do what's called a click color temperature. So you will sometimes have a little eyedropper like this, where you can click on that, and then you can click on a set of pixels on your image that should be white. So maybe this little house, for example, right here. Now, if you're, now we can see that this, it has made this white and the greens are more correct and a variety of other things. Now, if you're taking a photo of something that where color is of the utmost importance, then usually this is a pretty good way to go. Take the photo in RAW, but what you can also do is first take a photograph of something that you know should be just pure gray or pure white. So there's overpriced little cards that will do this for you, but you can also literally just get good enough with results with like a sheet of paper, you know, as long as it's not lined or something like that. Just take a picture of that with, you know, not right in front of the camera, but a good distance away, so you get the light hitting off that. Then you can get that color temperature using this eyedropper and then apply that same color temperature to all of your subsequent images, and you'll be able to adjust the color for a variety of situations. Now, that will only remain true as long as the light doesn't change. In this case, that would probably be a bad idea because the light is changing literally by the second, and the color is also changing as the sun goes down. And so I'd have to be retaking that photo over and over and over again. Now, if you insist on taking a photo in JPEG format, which is fine after the class, I guess, what you can do is set custom white balance on your camera. Now, this is usually different. The steps are different depending on what camera you have. But generally, you do a similar thing. You take a picture of something white, and you fill the frame with it. And then you tell the camera that you want to use this photo as a custom white balance marker. And then it calculates the white balance from that. And then you can set the camera to custom white balance, and it will use that white balance in all of the subsequent photos. This is particularly useful if you are taking photos of a very constant amount of light. So if you have like a home studio with some flashes set up, or even some, not even some flashes, but just some desk lamps or just something set up, then you will be able to use this to adjust and correct your color quite well. Okay, now just to give you an example of a difficult situation for us. Let's see. So this photo here, which we saw just prior, is actually a very difficult situation for a camera because there are a mix of lights. So there are these fluorescent lights that exist around the building, but then there's also the lights on the car itself, and then some additional flashes that were used to provide additional illumination. And so we have this change. We have this variety of colors that we could use. So I could try to use this eyedropper and pick one. Now, if you have a situation like this, you're pretty much out of luck. You can usually find a white balance that is acceptable to you, but you have to kind of fish around for it and find out what works best for you. So clicking on this, it works fine. The colors look good, but now the problem is that it just looks looks dull. The colors are not as good. What you generally want to do is find a region that is white that light is reflected off of. You generally don't want to click on a light source itself, as that will just bring you probably back to your original problem. But a reflection of a light is generally a good way to go. So if I can do this well enough. Okay. Well, it's hard to do right here. At home, I'm a pro with this, as I'm sure you can. Okay, that's not good. All right. Well, you can imagine that I click on this spot right here, and it looks awesome. And it really does. All right. All right, that's a bit better. Okay, yeah, I like that. That's a lot better. So now we've adjusted for some of the color, so it doesn't have that yellow cast that it had before, but it retains some of the color rather than looking purely metallic and looking purely gray. And so this was the look that you wanted to go for. And really, it can take some experimentation by clicking on different things, but at that point, what you might want to try to do is literally just adjust the color temperature until you see something that looks good. So remember that I talked about when you have higher temperatures, it's a bluer light, right? And so to compensate for that, when we increase the color temperature slider here, we're going to make it more red. We're going to make it warmer to compensate for the cooler colors, if that makes sense, okay? So this now is, because it was opposite before, now that it's opposite again, this is now how we would expect it. By increasing the temperature to be higher, it actually appears to be warmer in this particular case. And so by adjusting these sliders, you'll be able to find a particular color temperature that suits you and your particular photo quite well. I'm sorry? It's a 135, not an M3. Okay, yes, another question.
Did you have original value on that temperature?
Did I have original value?
Yeah, when you adjusted it, like, what would be the difference if you changed that?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
When you were sliding the scale, adjusting the color temperature?
Yes.
What was the, when you imported this photo into this program, mm-hmm.
There is a value that, so almost always the camera will do an automatic white balance and embed that value into the file, and then you will be able it will assume that color temperature when it's processing the photo. You can override that, and that is what we're doing here. Now, this particular piece of software I think sucks. This is the Canon software, and it doesn't actually tell me what the as shot color temperature was, because if I go to shot settings, then I notice that it goes to the default, and then whenever I go to color temperature, it always shifts it for some reason, no matter, even if it's straight out of the camera, so I don't actually see what it originally was. But good pieces of software like Aperture or Adobe Camera Raw or Lightroom will tell you what the original color temperature was, and you can modify from that point. You can modify to make it cooler from that point, to make it warmer. And sometimes you are also given additional values as well. You can make it a little, you can add more magenta, you can add more cyan. It really just depends on what you're trying to do. Well, one quick announcement. So I think we are not going to do the section on Wednesday, right? Because that is the day before Thanksgiving, and it's probably not a good day for that anyway. But if you have any questions, please do feel free to email us directly, and we'll be able to answer them. So with that said, thank you all for coming, and we'll see you next week.